warm welcome to our Thursdays with David Foster Wallace series, where we every week read a section of the infamous Infinite Jest with the hope, of course, of finishing the book by the end of the year. Today's section is pages 638 to 682 in the 20th anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text published by Little Brown and Company. Our only announcement for this week, other than the fact that we're finishing the book in less than 2 months? What? We are finishing early, and that means we need ideas for episodes for the end of the year. And I'm definitely going to do an episode on the word fantods, because I'm so intrigued by it, and I'm so intrigued by the grammar of it. And I know it's a noun, usually it's a noun in Infinite Jest, so more on that at the end of the book, and I want to talk about the narrator, I want to talk about a lot of things, but if you have ideas for episodes after we finished Infinite Jest, give me a ring or leave a comment. Awesome. The second announcement is our Patreon page. If you're listening to this on July 4th, it looks like this will be going up a little late on July 4th. Happy July 4th, Americans. Awesome holiday for us. And today is the last day to get a signed postcard by yours truly by signing up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/relevanceofliterature. We have lots of tiers now, well, 3 tiers, and they start at $2, end at $7, and it's a great way to just support and underwrite the show. It's so vital for us at this point to have some grassroots support from our audience, and I want to thank you guys who have signed up already. It's been awesome to get you guys on that community and to live stream with you, to ask questions and chat with you. It's just been really awesome to create that smaller community there. And if you are not in a place to support the show financially, it's not a problem at all. We just love that you're with us and that you're reading with us and that you're thinking with us. I think it's just so important to have people in the audience of all walks of life. If you want to leave a comment on Apple Podcasts, that is another way to support the show that doesn't necessarily have to be monetary. So thank you guys so much. I appreciate it really from the bottom of my heart. Awesome. We're starting at 1st of May, YDAU, outcropping northwest of Tucson, Arizona, USA, page 638 in the novel. It starts out with a story, and Steeply's father apparently was addicted to a TV program called MASH, and it's a really slow build, and so he starts by getting into MASH, and he's, you know, it's a normal fandom type of obsession, and he just watches it after work, essentially, but then it starts getting a little more serious, and it starts escalating to a point where he's missing days at work, and he is writing crazy fan theories in a journal and sending letters to what ends up being Fox Studios. He's trying to send them to South Korea, where the show is based. And there's all these military terms, and he's writing a book at the end about MASH, and it really consumes his whole life, and he ends up dying, actually, in a way that's so similar to the medical attaché in when the medical attaché is watching Infinite Jest. And this story is really interesting, and it's a really poignant one to start out the show with today, because I think it's really cueing us into the different levels or modes of sensitivity that certain people have to media. And this book and postmodernism, and if you want to call it post-postmodernism, you can. All of those genres, which I really consider one genre to a certain extent, have to do with this takeover of media and this mass consumerism and how you yourself get consumed by your own consumption. And this is definitely what happens to the medical attaché, this is what happens to people who watch Infinite Jest, and of course to Steeply's own father. And this, of course, explains some of the before that we have gotten from Steeply, where he's saying, I've really had curiosity to try out Infinite Jest, and it seems like he would definitely be someone who would be susceptible to this kind of addiction. So, entertainment. We start out just with a really interesting sub-story about entertainment in general, and there's going to be a lot of comments about entertainment in general, and about consumption, and about media and television, in this episode as a whole. And so one thing that I wanted to add in addition to that is that this section was added later in terms of the actual transcript of the book. This whole thread with Marith and Steeply was added much later, and that makes total sense to me because it seems like DFW wrote this section when he was really clear and aware on the goal of post-postmodernism, on those themes that he's talking about. And I really want to go back to the interview that we talked about in the critical reception episode where DFW is getting interviewed, but it's a literary interview, so he's writing his answers, not saying them. And I just love his discussion of media and his discussion of television in general in that whole interview. I'll link it down below for all of you who are interested. And yeah, I think that there is something to be said of where this thread came in the actual drafting of this book, because again, it does seem like DFW included it after he was super, super clear and wanted maybe to add something more a la his goals of post-postmodernism here. And there's an interesting sort of vignette about Marith and his shadow, and I'm wondering what the significance of Marith's turning so drastically to look at his shadow. He notes Steeply's shadow as well in this thread, and I think in terms of what I thought about it, I thought it was a little bit connected to the themes of disability and ability in this text, maybe appearances, also a huge theme. This book is very visual, as I've realized. And I think it just like adds to this sense of, okay, Marith is like really caught up in the visual, in the changing of the scenes. We know that while this section isn't narrated by Marith per se, it does have particular emphasis on him. And the scenery, the sunset and the sunrise, all of these are really duly noted by Marith or by the narrator through Marith. Something in between, maybe the narrator has more emphasis at some sections than others. But yeah, I'm caught up by this attention to the shadow and this attention to what's behind the two, what's protruding from the two. Maybe it's a metaphor for the truth or something, or the metaphor for how they have to be shaded in some ways and have to hide and maybe misplace the truth at some points. So yeah, I thought this shadow moment was really powerful. But I want to know what you guys attributed it to. Was it something having to do with the theme of, you know, disfigurement? Or was it something that adds just to the visual nature of the novel? Maybe both. Or is it something that does add to, maybe as a metaphor, to this vision of truth in the novel? Which I think we get to in a big way when we get to Orin in this section. I have a quote for you on page 642. Quote, "It sometimes from somewhere blue occurred to Marith that he did not dislike this Steeply, though like or respect would be too far in going to say." And I wanted to note that there's blue here, and we haven't seen blue in a while, at least not in a very overt way. I think this is an important quote because it's something that really is going forward and clearly, at least more clearly than we've seen before, defining Marith and Steeply's relationship, at least from one of their perspectives. And so, you know, Marith is, I don't want to say he's fond of Steeply, but it seems like their relationship is a little bit more in depth than maybe we were allowing ourselves to think before as readers, at least as I was allowing myself to think before. And yeah, I wanted to link this article in the description that one of our avid commenters and listeners has sent to me via email. Our email's in the description if you'd like to contact us there. And it's about color coding Infinite Jest, and it's so interesting. And this is one of the places where I think it's really important to, again, look at the visual nature of the novel, look at the color scheme of the novel, and this blue thing. It makes sense to me that if Incandenza is the narrator, that he would note somewhere blue in particular, because he has such an interesting relationship with the color in earlier parts of the novel, where we're looking at his childhood, for example. Back to the narrative here, I wanted to note one more thing about Steeply and his family's experience with MASH, which is that his mummikins, as he says, really plays at normality the whole time. So she starts taking anti-anxiety meds halfway through the experience, but that's the only thing she changes about her life or their lives. She really just pretends that everything's fine and she just sort of shells up, it seems like. And so I'm really interested in this theme because I think her experience is sort of a micro representation of much of the novel, because I think a lot of this novel is about deviations from quote unquote normal. And I wanted to ask, who do you guys think is the most normal character in the novel? I know this isn't the most productive question to ask in solving the narrative or anything, but I think normality is an interesting topic that we haven't discussed so much before. And I think we do take for granted that, you know, all of these characters, they're so deep. They have so much. They have so much depth in them. And it makes it hard to sense their abnormality in a lot of ways. And maybe their abnormalities are what makes them normal or more normal than most people. So, and I guess it does depend on the definition for normal. So, if you have a character that you think is the most normal, I guess the first thing would be to define normal in your comment. And for me, I want to define normal. I almost want to put normal and functioning side by side. So, normality is a product of being functional, being independent. And so, I'm not sure who the most normal person in the book would be. I almost want to say Green for some reason, even though he's not quite functional. Maybe I don't want to say Gately, but yeah, I don't want to say Avril either. It's really hard. It's a really hard question to think about. But I think I'm going to land on Green, and I think because he's the character that's pointed towards the direction of being functional and independent, and it seems like in a near future he's going to take care of things better and manage them better than he has in the past. So we'll see. Maybe redemption is a part of my normal sort of making mistakes and getting back up from them. But I'd love to know what you guys think. It's an interesting thought experiment here. And at 6:48, the end of this little passage, this little thread, we have the word misplaced. And there, it's an interesting bit of information and teamwork for us because they are describing the eyes of the people that they've seen who have been taken up by the cartridge. Or in this case, Steeply's father's eyes as well. He has a similar look about him. And, they settle on lost or misplaced as the two words that these eyes seem to denote. It's like they're not wholly gone, but it does seem like their attentions are completely elsewhere, like out of their body, kind of. And so, what's interesting to me is that this section is a bit of teamwork on their behalf. It seems like they're using their linguistic knowledge and experience together for once, whereas oftentimes I really equate their conversations to Oren and Hal's conversations on the phone, where there's two different conversations going on depending on who's speaking. But here it really seems to intertwine better than it has in other places of the novel, and I thought that was also an indicator of maybe a growing fondness for each other or something. But yeah, and they do start to sort of fight and be at odds at the end between these two words, misplaced and lost. But at the same time, it really was an interesting linguistic sort of teamwork that they were doing, and I thought that was definitely something to note. Now, on page 638, we have another title, 13th of November, YDAU, 2 days after our main thread that we've really focused on thus far in the novel. We start out here with Ken, Erdetti, Bruce Green, Joffrey Day, Kate Gompert, all in the common room together late at night after the Gately incident. The Gately incident likely took place on the 11th of November, 2 days before. We hear on page 654, a little later, that Gately is in the hospital. My question is, where is Joelle? I want to know more about the how Gately got from point A to point B. What hand, other than what we've seen already, has Joelle played in all of this? And I'm wondering, you know, it seems like she would also be pretty messed up by what happened because she cares so much for Gately. And I just want to know where she is, what she's up to. Has she met Mario yet? All of these questions that will go unanswered, unfortunately, for this episode. So Joffrey Day is, I'm not sure what his first name is. I think it's Joffrey or something. Day is talking about a shadow figure that appeared in his childhood when he was playing the violin. So there was this air conditioner, swamp cooler type apparatus on the window, and it was vibrating all of that and creating a high-pitched sort of frequency. And when he was playing the violin in the bathroom, and there was a certain tone that matched the intensity of the frequency and combined somehow, I think maybe what he did, honestly, from my music background, is he might have hit a note that was the resonance of the room. So when you sing or you play a note that's the resonance of the room, like that pitch matches the pitch of the room, everything is amplified like sevenfold. It's really interesting. And if you want to test this, go into your bathroom, go into an elevator or somewhere where you can sing and not be embarrassed, and just sing like low pitches to high pitches slowly, and there will be a pitch in there where you can maintain your same volume, but it sounds much louder. I think that's what might have happened. And anyway, this resonance pitch mixed with that vibrant pitch from the air conditioner window system in such a way that it sort of messed with Day's brain, and he saw this like shadow figure coming towards him. And he's not that descriptive about it. I think maybe because it's linked to trauma, and maybe because it's totally made up in his brain, so he can't really put it into words. But yeah, this shadow thing was terrifying, like death itself, kind of terrifying. And he apparently witnessed this for years. Like his last one was in college, apparently, and it just terrifies him the whole time, and it does not put him in the right place. And so that's what they're talking about. And Green is asleep on the couch. They're not supposed to sleep on the couch, so all of their positions are they're almost staged in a way, like a movie or like a play. That's another very cinematic thing about this scene in particular, is that their positions, their postures are almost staged. I know that Kate Gompert is like slouched down on the couch in such a way that her neck is, you know, kinked and stiff, and yeah, it doesn't seem comfortable for sure. But Green is asleep, and he is shouting, or he's not shouting, he's just saying interjections of just random things in his sleep. And it seems like he's having a dream about something that he is not happy about having a dream about. And so it makes the scene very restless. And I know this scene takes place at 2 in the morning, and they're not supposed to be there, but they're there because of the Gately incident, and it's just a little bit nightmarish, a little bit restless, sort of like one of the scenes later in the book with these kids going through the tunnels. We're getting to that. Page 651, 11th of November, YDAU, 2 days earlier. There's an in-depth vision, this in-depth, like, play-by-play description of the tennis match between Hal and O'Stice. It's really interesting. This is our first, as far as I remember, there's a lot of tennis jargon, a lot of the warm-ups and pukers and things that we've seen earlier in the novel. Those were, of course, in-depth descriptions. We were looking at how they are training. We're looking at the recreational aspect of ETA, the social aspect a lot of times, but here's an actual gameplay, and this stands out in the novel for sure. In 654, there's a quote that has the word phantods in it. I'll read the first part. Quote, gave everyone watching the phantods. Incredible use of this noun. I really want to look at this noun, as I said earlier. But just so you note, that's another use of the word phantods. Page 655, we have a really... 654, 655 is a really interesting... it's like three different narratives all at once. So there it's paragraph, 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 like bam, bam, bam. Updates on a lot of people. And so at this point, poor Tony Krause has not had a seizure yet, actually. He's still in the library detoxing. And we get the thing about Gately, and then there's the thing about ETA. And so I think it really does help to position ourselves or reposition ourselves, reorient ourselves within the narrative to have these three different paragraphs like that right in a row. I know some people might find it a little disorienting, but I like how the book keeps going back and referencing itself. It's a really meta feature of this book in some ways. Footnote 266 is talking about CT's amazing ability to, I guess, to make parents feel that their kids are safe. And so this is in regards to the Estreton match, and a lot of the kids are injured and their parents are coming to ETA and talking with CT, and he is so good at convincing them everything's okay, we're doing good. I think what he does is really confuse them into loops. So they're like, yeah, everything's, you know, he wraps them in a false sense of security and openness. So much so that they get distracted, and they oftentimes, it was noted in the novel, they don't even stop in and visit their kids who are injured. And so it's a really interesting fact about CT. There's a relation of CT and Oren later in the book, which we'll talk about. I'm excited to talk about Oren, if you can't notice. And it's a good thing, because on 655, there's a paragraph about Oren with this, quote, Swiss, unquote, woman, again, in a different hotel, though she's probably A, Quebecois, and B, tied to the wheelchair assassins in some way, shape, or form. And there was an interesting comment on the blog where this person was talking about how her hands sort of resemble Avril's hands. Like, Avril's hands are really sleek and slender and beautiful, and so are hers. And I found this really interesting because we learn later in the novel, I'm just gonna talk about it now, we learn later in the novel that Oren defines himself a lot of times in opposition to Avril, because there's this discussion about abuse, which I will save for later, but yeah, he defines himself in opposition to Avril, and it's really interesting to me that it seems like this subject of his is connected to Avril in at least these physical kind of ways. I don't think it's any mistake that this affair and what we learn about Oren and Avril's relationship are within the same 40-page span in the novel. On page 656, I just wanted to point this out because it was really bothering me. It's this Mrs. Steepley, this Stice. Why do they keep using the demonstrative here? It's like, it's really interesting. I got really frustrated at the narrator here because usually when you use the demonstrative, it would be in a deictic way. So in a way where you point to something or physically gesture. So if I was with my family and I said, this is my brother, I would gesture with my body somehow to indicate that this person next to me is my brother. I'm not sure about the mechanics of this exactly, but what my thoughts are is that the narrator is using the demonstrative to somehow show his involvement within the text. So we know that Dr. I is definitely dead by this point. I'm wondering if the narrator is Dr. I, which I'm not sure about still. I just want to just point that out. I'm entertaining it, I'm thinking about it, but I'm not 100%, and I don't want you all to be either about who the narrator is. And so I'm thinking, if this was Dr. I, who is he moving through in this scene? And it doesn't seem like he has any one particular focus. He focuses on Stice and Hal, and on Steeply, on Delint, and later on Potrancourt. And it's a really interesting, it's almost an omniscient viewpoint, and that's pretty different from some of the other sections that we've just come from. So yeah, I think that first of all, this use of the demonstrative, this Mrs. Steeply, this Stice, is deictic. I think that he is gesturing, that someone is gesturing in this passage. Second of all, I think that this gesturing thing, this use of the demonstrative, is indicating involvement, like physical or personal involvement. And that is just what I have garnered from the text. I could be wrong. I'm totally cool with being wrong. But I do think that the use of the demonstrative is really interesting here. Certainly, it could be infelicitous as well. It could be some sort of error from someone's thoughts. That certainly could be the case. But yeah, I do think it's really important to also look at, on these micro levels, like, what is the significance of using this versus the, or this versus just Mrs. Steeply. Awesome. So another, like, really interesting moment that I think also heightens our perspective or perception of the narration itself is when Steeply drops his pen on the bleachers. So Steeply drops it. You know how bleachers make all those metal, like, crunching sounds when you move on them? Stice is serving, in the midst of serving, and he bounces the ball a couple more times, I think in response to the noise. And this also has to do with, so there's this overarching perspective, right? And I think that it's beautifully coordinated between the dropping of the pen and Stice's subconscious reaction to it. The second part of this scene that I think is really important is that we later get into aspects of ETA, why ETA is set up as it is, what is Stitt's whole goal at ETA, what is he doing, why is he using all these crazy methods to train these kids, other than the fact that they want to be elite athletes. And we learn that it's about their mental capacity, and he's really, like, oven hardening them. I think that's one of the terms they use, really, like, oven hardening them for their stints in the show, if they do get them. And so it articulates perfectly what they're explaining about ETA and their mental status. And so we see that Stice and Hal are so detached from the game itself. They're super detached, not from the game itself, but from the audience itself. Yeah, I want to make that distinction. Hal goes in and out of the game. It's really interesting. And they talk about the emotional status of Hal, for sure. But yeah, Hal and Stice, they're distant from the audience. And that's something that's interesting as well in terms of our themes of entertainment, because they essentially are going to become entertainers, right? And so it almost seems like to save them, they have to be distant from the actual entertainment aspect of it, which is just, yeah, it's such an interesting concept. I want to know more about what you guys think about this entertainment show thing, and about this scene in particular. Did you also pick out this scene as really important? On page 658, we have a quote here, quote, "It was unlikely that any one game figured much in the entertainment." This is perfectly suiting our conversation that we were just having. Infinite Jest, I want to say, is also the book, right? So this is getting really meta, but there's Infinite Jest the cartridge and Infinite Jest the book, and I think it's really important to consider both. And so he's saying it's unlikely that any one game figured much in Infinite Jest the cartridge, but actually one game does figure prominently in Infinite Jest the book, which is the entertainment in some respects. And I'm wondering, what's our role as readers in this entertainment? Because In essence, in some respects, we are the ones watching Infinite Jest. We are the ones subjecting ourselves to a 1,000-plus-page novel plus all these endnotes. And so we are the audience of the cartridge in some ways, I think. And I know that's a really meta thought, but I was just thinking, like, Infinite Jest has consumed a lot of my life over the past year, and I've thought about it a lot, and maybe that's the point, is that there's this meta aspect of being a reader of Infinite Jest, where you sort of also take on the qualities of these people who are infinitely entertained by the cartridges. I want to know your thoughts about that. I know that was, like, pretty crazy, pretty far out there, but I think it's important to consider the role of the title in this book, and is the title meaning to stand in for the actual cartridge? Is the book a metaphor or a symbol or an allegory for the actual cartridge itself? And also, I just want to, like, last point here, mention that there are people who are obsessed with this book, way more than we are at the show, which, you know, we've gotten really far deep into this book. We've looked at a lot in this book, but there are people who write, you know, a lot about this book. They're obsessed with this book in a way that I think, maybe not coincidentally, mirrors the people who become obsessed and can only think about the cartridge, which I just think is so interesting and so, almost so, it really indicates a lot of DFW's foresight in some ways. But maybe it wasn't intentional. Who knows? On 659, there's a quote that tennis is equated to, quote, chess on the run, unquote. I really like this description of tennis. I think that describes how DFW thinks about tennis, especially. And so this is one of those quotes, one of those gems that really came out to me because I thought, wow, it seems like DFW right there. It seems like he's speaking to us, maybe not the narrator, maybe not whomever we're focusing on. So on 661, I'm going to read this passage about ETA and Shtit, and this is DeLint speaking, page 661. Assume wrongly for a second that I can speak for the Enfield Academy. I say you do not get it. The point here for the best kids is to inculcate their sense that it's never about being seen. It's never. If they can get that inculcated, the show won't F them up, Shtit thinks. If they can forget everything but the game, when all of you out there outside the fence see only them and want only them, and the game's incidental to you, for you it's about entertainment and personality. It's about the statue. But if they can get inculcated right, they'll never be slaves to the statue. They'll never blow their brains out after winning an event when they win, or dive out a third-story window when they start to stop getting poked at or profiled, when their blossom starts to fade. Whether or not you mean to, babe, you chew them up. It's what you do. So he's talking to Steeply here. And I just think that's such an interesting description of ETA and the goals of ETA. And again, as I mentioned earlier, I pretty much dissected this quote earlier because I got too excited. But essentially, it really does talk, and I think it connects the Tennis Academy with the entertainment in such a big way. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Dr. I founded ETA, and he seems like, it seems like at least in part he would have encountered this problem, and that's why he wanted Shtit in particular to head the coaching at ETA. And so it seems like he was thinking about this problem of entertainment, and then he eventually created the ultimate entertainment. And yeah, I think it ties up a lot of the threads of the story and the experiences really well. We're getting to a point in the story where the threads are really starting to intersect. For example, Steeply is at ETA. This is a huge intersection of two major threads, the conversation and the ETA thread. And I've heard so many, like, complaints about this book to me, people who have read it and hated it, who have started to read it and hated it and didn't finish it. People who overall liked it but were unsatisfied by it. For me, though, I think that with this kind of reading, with this very slow kind of reading, we on the show, and this includes you commenters, you participators, people who've been reading along, we all together, I think, have really broken down the intersection of, intersections of the text in a way that I find deeply satisfying, in a way that I at least find to be really valuable. And so, yeah, thank you guys for helping me so much with this novel so far. And yeah, I just want to congratulate us, sort of, because it seems like, at least to me, I'm really fulfilled by the way that we're getting into the text and the way that these threads are connecting. And I'm actually pretty satisfied with it. You know, I was expecting all these threads to be super distant by the way people were talking about it, but these threads are so interconnected, and I find that, again, deeply satisfying, deeply interesting as well. Awesome. So on, there is a letter, sequence of letters, starting on page 63, and Steeply is writing a letter to Marlon Bane, which is Orin's childhood friend, and Marlon Bane essentially says, yep, I'll answer however many questions I need to answer for you, it's okay, and, we get a lot from Marlon Bane, actually. We get a lot of info from him. And so what I found interesting is he seems to work for the same company as Green's father, the gag company, Acme. And he really, Marlon really falls off the deep end in his footnotes. And one way that this is indicated is he keeps messing up Steeply's name, like in big ways. Like, one of them was Mrs. Steely, like, without the P, and then he just gets, like, way far off. Like, he starts doing, like, Mrs. Stechmesser, like, that wasn't one of them, but, like, really far away, like, deviations of Steeply's name. And so it's really interesting how we get so much information from him, but I think that these indications of him falling off the deep end are again another thing about, like, his own personal bias that he's bringing. And again, this is really the first time we've met this character, and he has such a human perspective. He's not a shallow minor motivating character at all, by any means. And so, yes, we have an upcoming footnote coming up here, and we really get this a lot of tidbits of information, so I'll start to talk about those. So first of all, we hear that a word appeared on Avril's window of her car. So there was a fogged window in her car, and a word, just like someone wrote a word with their finger on it, and I think it has to do with Avril's affair. I don't know where I'm getting that from, but I'm pretty sure that we've already heard about this fogged window before. B, I'm pretty sure that it has to do somewhat with Avril's affair, because it sort of wreaks havoc in the Incandenza household. And so Marlon doesn't really get into what it was, what the word was. I'm so curious. But yeah, if there's a passage that you all can lead me to in the text where we can talk about this sort of affair, like mystery kind of thing, more, I would love to read that in the next episode. So Orin, we get a lot about Orin here, and this is where Orin and CT are juxtaposed against one another. Apparently Orin shares this sort of fake openness with CT, where they give their... Marlon almost wants to say victims, I feel like. He has a very negative view of Orin. But where they give the people they're interacting with, this, like, false view of openness, where in fact they're closed shut inside. And so he says that Orin has almost a pathological way of picking up girls. And I think that, like, the text has certainly hinted at this quality of Orin before, but no one has ever just said it for what it is. And I was sort of relieved and grateful to Marlon for just saying it for what it was. Because Orin, as we saw in the first hotel scene with the quote-unquote Swiss hand model, he's really quote-unquote open. He's really, seems like he wants to match whatever emotion she'd like, and that is, it seems like, at least from what we know, not a healthy and not a genuine way to approach these kinds of relationships. And so, yeah, it's really interesting. It's a really poignant aspect of Marlin's observations about Oren and about the Incandenza family as a whole. All right, I have a quote here from page 1048. We're still in the footnote, of course. Quote, "It is not that Oren Incandenza is a liar, but that I think he has come to regard the truth as constructed instead of reported." I think this is a really observant and interesting point from this friend of his, and the friend really makes Avril out to be the source of Oren's problems. I won't go as far to say the source of the Incandenza's problems as a whole, because I think that when he was around, when Marlin was around, Mario and Hal were both just sort of young kids, and they weren't really developed at that point, but certainly, because Oren defines himself in opposition to her again, that is a really big indication that definitely some of his problems, at least, are from Avril, especially from the perspective of this friend, right? So a lot of his perspective is limited to how much he was around, what periods he was around in, and it just seems like he doesn't have the most complete perspective of Oren and the Incandenzas, but he is one important part of the story here, one important piece of the puzzle. So S. Johnson was Avril's beloved dog, and there's a story about Marlin and Oren. Essentially, Marlin and Oren get high one day, and the dog is still leashed to the back of the car, and they start driving around Boston like crazy people, and we all know what happens to the dog. It's a horrible story. How many dogs have been killed in Infinite Jest so far? I just want to ask that. Between Lens and this, it's just, there's a lot of dogs dying, okay? And it's interesting because DFW reportedly watched a video of a golden retriever on loop while he was editing this book, and so it's just an interesting additive here that he really watched a video of a dog over and over while he was editing and was killing all these dogs. And the footnote itself is pretty chilling, the letter itself that Marlin writes. And there, it ends with a little vignette that he recounts about Oren and his imitation of the moms, and Oren putting on this big, seemingly genuine smile and sort of coming very close to people at parties. And this mimics exactly the nature of Avril after they kill S. Johnson, the dog, where she's torn up. She has this big funeral for the dog. She is just devastated for days and weeks and has probably not recovered to this date. Yet she becomes more affectionate, more loving, more accommodating towards Oren. And that's what Marlin categorizes somewhat as abuse, is he says that that just was not an appropriate reaction to what had happened. And it was so clear that Oren was lying, and he's talking about Oren and how he really can't lie very well, and it's probably because of the moms, and we know Hal also has problems with lying and the moms and these weird interactions with her, and so her sincerity, to a certain extent, I think is what Marlin categorizes as abuse. So we go back to the under-14s. They're in trouble from the Esteton game. These are, of course, people like Lamont Chu and Kitten Plan, who have not been injured in the game, necessarily. And so, right in the middle of this thread, actually, is the golden mean of the book. So that's on page 667. If you guys find anything about 667 that you think is particularly like vital in any way to the book, let me know. I didn't find anything. I actually think that 661 is a better candidate for the golden mean because it's talking about entertainment, and that's pretty much the crux of this book in many ways. And I think that page is way more pivotal. Also, it's pretty close. Like, it's pretty interesting how close DFW does get to this golden mean. I just find it really cool how a lot of art just naturally imitates this golden mean thing. And also, Yeah, it's that, you know, we're looking at pages here, but you could also look at words. And so maybe the golden mean word is pivotal for this book. Honestly, I think a lot of golden mean words are the word the, because it's the most common word in the English language. But yeah, anywho, I just wanted to mention that's the golden mean section. And this, going back to the narrative, this part of the narrative is them paving the way for the lung. And so the lung is about to be erected, about to be put up, and the boys are going through the tunnels. They're cleaning stuff out. There's a lot of garbage and random assorted stuff there, and Lamont Chu is making a list of all the big stuff. There's a lot of mini fridges and trunks back there that old ETA alums have left just in the tunnels. And so, yeah, they're really cleaning out trash and just paving the way so people can get in there and get the parts for the lung and get everything in order. And I think the tone is really different in this part of the novel. There was a part earlier with Green and this sort of like skittish, nightmarish type tone. It's a little bit similar here, and because the boys, they have a mission also of their own accord, which is to find this hamster. They think that there's a concavity hamster in the tunnels, and so it's sort of like R.L. Stine or Stephen King in a way. I hesitate always to make comparisons between authors, but if you were having trouble characterizing this section, I just think that DFW really does well by these kids in terms of like embodying their voice, and those are two authors who also embody children's voices super, super well. I've read extensively R.L. Stine and extensively Stephen King as well. Those two are like, they were, when I was a kid, R.L. Stine was a huge influence of mine, and of course, I was introduced to Stephen King through our horrifying classic. So, and I find his writing really interesting too. So, yeah, if I were a kid, I would have loved reading this section because he just embodies, DFW does a really great job of embodying children, which is not a common trait in a lot of like serious highbrow literature kind of authors. So this kid called Blot again saw a concavity hamster supposedly in the tunnels. And so there's two reasons why this hamster is important. The first is that it could distract from a big buddy punishment. So Pemulus, Axford, and Hal are all getting punished, and it could, the finding the hamster or seeing it could distract from their punishments being fulfilled. And we know that Hal is very affected by this, so it's interesting that the big or the little buddies sort of pick up on this. And it also could explain these weird misplaced items around ETA. We haven't gotten anything else about this except for that maybe the concavity hamsters are putting random things in the kitchen and on the grounds of ETA. And they essentially find a mini fridge that was not cleaned out when the alum moved out, and they think they're like, a hamster, there's no way a hamster could have been attracted to all of this disgusting putrid food. And so they see the mini fridge, they open it, and they flee. And it's hilarious because there's a note in the other frame of this narrative where Steeply's on the bleachers and he actually sees them as they're lugging the trash bags out of the tunnels and and disposing of them. So I thought that was a funny, again, another connection between frames that maybe one could miss very easily. All right, last section here. We've gotten a lot from DeLint at this point, in terms of DeLint talking to Steeply back and forth, and Steeply's, you know, I think a little nonplussed by DeLint's atmosphere and his responses. But Poutrincourt is someone who, she's a prorector, and she has a very interesting description. That's on page 674 if you're curious. But she really steals DeLint's thunder and explains a lot to Steeply about ETA and about the fragility of prodigies. And so, yeah, there's this really interesting contrast between Poutrincourt, who is Quebecois, and DeLint, who's not. And Poutrincourt has a lot of similar features to Murraith, and so that makes Steeply flag her. And then in footnote 276, we note that Poutrincourt has noticed that Steepley is, or likely has noticed, that Steepley is neither a woman nor a profiler by the angle of how he lights his cigarettes. And my final questions for you guys today are, what's Poutrincourt's role in all of this? Why bring her up so late, seemingly, in the novel and in the narrative? And also, what happened to Steepley's wife? Like, his wife is mentioned in bursts throughout this whole 40-page section. She's been mentioned before. Is she dead? It seems like she's died. And that's my question. Did I miss something from earlier in the novel, or am I just forgetting something from earlier in the novel? And this whole section ends on the emotional state of Hal and how his playing is in and out emotionally on the court, and he is affected a lot by these emotional sort of problems. And that does play a huge factor in why Steepley will likely not be allowed to profile him. Thank you all so much for tuning in today, and I really appreciate it. I really appreciate you guys' reading along with me, commenting, and supporting me. And I know that these episodes are a little bit sporadic. It's like weekends with David Foster Wallace at this point, but I'm doing my best. I am the only one putting these episodes together at this point, so it's been a long road, but I love doing it, and I love you guys' feedback. So if you have any tips for me about how to read the book faster/better, let me know in the comments down below, or email me, didianandhawthorne@gmail.com. And also, Patreon, if you love the show, if you get value and meaning from this show, would like to help get this show out to other people who might find value and meaning to it, or in it, patreon.com/relevanceofliterature. You could also, if you want to learn more, go to relevanceofliterature/patreon. So both of those links work for that. Thank you guys so much again. Have a great holiday weekend if you are American, and I will see you soon. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.